You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome, citizens, to This Day in History with Benjamin J. Goldson.
Yes, this day in history, going back to 2012, the Matakane mine shooting. So this took place in South Africa after a wildcat strike by miners. That's when you go on strike without the permission of your sort of union hierarchy.
Nice.
Because the National Union of Mine Workers had been quite sort of hostile to the strikers' demands. In response, they'd sort of armed themselves with sticks and clubs, had these standoffs with the police. That culminated in the shooting, which left around 30 dead, a bunch more wounded. And this was seen at the time as quite a shock, especially for outsiders, I think, because South Africa was seen as, sort of after they got rid of their legal apartheid system, that things were sort of all right in South Africa, that they weren't. You didn't have these lasting sort of economic segregation. But after apartheid had been removed, after first being installed in a series of decrees in the mid-century, which led to South Africa voting to leave the British Commonwealth, which had objected to these laws.
Celebrating its golden jubilee, the Union of South Africa, certainly prosperous Johannesburg, forgot apartheid and remembered the settlement of 1910, by which the Dutch and British out there became one nation. But still revered is the memory of Paul Kruger, Britain's implacable enemy in the Boer War. He died 6 years before the Cape Town Parliament began its career as the legislature of the new nation. The Boer War legacy of bitterness largely faded as the first cabinet of the Union of South Africa, Louis Botha, its first premier, assumed office. General Smuts, for many years, continued Botha's enlightened policy, till in a general election, he was voted out. From country obscurity emerged Dr. Malan. Apartheid was born, though few outside South Africa then realized its significance. High up near Bulawayo, visited by the great and humble alike, lies the tomb of Cecil Rhodes. Not in South Africa, but in the country of his creation, Rhodesia. Ironically, the famous empire builder, in his commercial activities, turning the early diamond rush into a vast industry, sowed the seeds of apartheid. For the diamond fields did more than turn Rhodes and his friends into millionaires. They called for cheap labor, Negro labor. And into South Africa came hordes of colored men, till now they outnumber whites 3-1. If it became 5-1, 10-1, how long could South Africa remain a white man's country? For not often appreciated in Britain is the fact that before the diamond and gold industries started the influx of colored labor, South Africa was a white man's country. There, the white man is the native, not the black. Unfortunately, the rulers of South Africa want matters both ways, cheap labor and segregation. Hence the recent rioting against having to carry passes. The pass files themselves were systematically burnt, but even then, little concession was made by the government. Outside criticism meant nothing to the Premier, Dr. Verfoort.
We shall become nobody's corpse. We shall fight for our existence. And we shall survive.
It was at that gathering that Dr. Verwoerd was shot. In a matter of minutes, the agricultural show was turned from a local event into a worldwide front-page sensation. Miraculously, the Premier was not killed. And as the would-be assassin was a white man, no race riots resulted. So on this golden jubilee, the shadow of apartheid lies over Cape Town and the whole of South Africa. Yet the 50 years of union now being celebrated have, for the most part, been a credit to the nation formed in 1910. All the Commonwealth hopes that South Africa will overcome her difficulties and that the next half century will bring justice, prosperity, and peace to all her people.
They wouldn't. Spoiler alert.
Oh, before you get into it, Ben.
Spoiler.
Someone's texted in about your piece. They said South Africa was a white man's country. Who wrote this shit?
Yeah, I mean, this is from the 60s.
Yeah, you know, gotta take it
British,
in its context.
British Parthe. Gotta take it up with them. Mm. But yes, despite that sort of rather glowing evaluation of South Africa as a revisionist history, South Africans did indeed vote to leave the British Commonwealth.
South Africa has made the expected choice, to be a republic. Indeed, despite lively opposition, especially in Johannesburg, it was the inevitable choice. So thoroughly did the government of Dr. Verfoerd organize the campaign, while allowing only white people to vote in the referendum. Verfoerd declared before polling day that if he only had a majority of one, the Union would become a republic. Women polled in strength while the men were at work. By no means did Dr. Verfoerd have it all his own way. For days in Joburg and all places of pro-British leaning, the opposition was strong. Sir de Villiers Graaf vigorously fought the Republican idea. He has opposed the Premier in Parliament. Now he's stumped the country with great success wherever the majority were of British blood. But nothing less than a republic would satisfy the Dutch-descended Afrikaners, who bitterly resent the defeat of their forebears, the Boers. That was at the beginning of the century, long before most of the voters were born. Dr. Verfoerd was all along determined to end the monarchy in South Africa. He was born in Holland during the Boer War, raised in the smarting years of defeat, and nearly 60 years later, he's restoring the republic overthrown when he was a babe in arms. Yet, as the referendum day wore on, it was clear that it would be a very close thing. Early figures were against the republic, but everybody, colored folks included, knew that the later returns would swing it the other way. And as only the whites were allowed to vote, the colored four-fifths of the population had no say in the choice. They were disconsolate when the result showed a Republican victory. What lies before her people, white and colored? What is South Africa's future in the Commonwealth?
That was part one of This Day in History. Part two will be right back after a quick break, but here is Chainmail Maker by Tiny Ruins.
Daisy taker, chainmail maker, what have you gone and done? Oh, tally breaker, salty shaker, you were the only one. Should we keep on? Why don't we sleep on keeping on? Should we keep on? Why don't we sleep on keeping on? Dockyard drones and battered bones, nothing of comfort here. Yellow livers, bandaged rivers, thinking of what I hold dear. You gotta keep on, try not to weep on, keeping on. You gotta keep on, try not to weep on, keeping on. And I give it, don't I deliver in black for morning tea? Long hair acre, deep dark acre, you gonna last just me. We gotta keep on, gotta keep on, keeping on. We gotta keep on, gotta keep on, keeping on. We gotta keep on, gotta keep on.
Your Kiwaha o te wiki, your saying of the week. This week,
Pauri atu, get out of the way.
Look at the line for tank, bro. How are we going to get lunch before class?
Watch me. Pauri atu to you all. We ordered online.
Eh, no we didn't.
Shh. They don't know that.
Pauri atu, get out of the way.
It's your Kiwaha o te wiki, brought to you by Ngā Tauira Māori, the University of Auckland Māori Students Association.
So, I'm doing the Cocktail Corner ad?
Yeah. Just read what's on the screen.
It just says Cocktail Corner?
Yeah. Just read it. Real slow.
Okay. Cocktail Corner?
That's great. Again, slower.
Cocktail Corner?
Yes.
Shouldn't I be saying like, Cocktail Corner, 5:30 every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive, thanks to Plantation Pineapple Rum and Bedford Soda and Liquor?
No, just read it one more time.
Is that Sade? And have you dimmed the lights?
Cocktail Corner, every Thursday on Drive.
But now it's time for part two of This Day in History. When we left off, South Africa just voted to leave the Commonwealth and install its apartheid system, which would be largely maintained for the next few decades, until it was ended, rather dramatically, with the freedom of longtime prisoner Nelson Mandela.
Good evening. For 27 years, 6 months and 6 days, he had been a prisoner. During that time, he became a legend, a symbol of black resistance to apartheid, and to many, he became a martyr. Tonight, he is a free man. Nelson Mandela, the leader of the African National Congress, he walked out of a prison on a gloriously sunny South African afternoon, and there is general agreement that his freedom begins a new era in South Africa. This is a special edition of Sunday Report. We're taking the time usually filled by Venture to bring you comprehensive coverage of a truly extraordinary day, a day so many have waited for so long, the day Nelson Mandela was freed from prison. We start with the CBC's Jean-Francois Lepin.
There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa.
Nelson Mandela emerged from his long nightmare as a simple man walking his way to freedom accompanied by his wife, Winnie. But his release meant probably more to the whole world than to the man himself. In an unprecedented move, state-controlled television beamed Mandela's release live into the homes of millions of South Africans. Outside, crowds of supporters had waited hours for that very first glimpse of the man that most of them had never even seen before. Mandela was then driven to a huge rally that had been building up since early morning to welcome him.
More than a quarter of a million people came here in the center of Cape Town, hoping to hear Mandela's first public address. At one point, the crowd was so dense and the security so inadequate that Mandela's motorcade couldn't make its way through.
Organizers spent hours trying to control the situation, but it only led to further unrest. As groups of people began to leave the rally, riots and looting broke out in the streets. And South African police forces reacted in panic, shooting almost indiscriminately. Dozens of people were wounded. Journalists were also hit. As the violence went on, Nelson Mandela finally showed up at the rally.
So yes, after Mandela was freed, there was certainly a sort of a sense, I think of the times, because it was in the 90s, around the same time you had the fall of the Berlin Wall, that this sort of was the end of history, that things would be all right now, that you'd gotten rid of the legal apartheid system. And I'm certainly sure things were better, but you still obviously had this ongoing economic inequality that the native Africans were more likely to be at the bottom mm-hmm. with the sort of white owners at the top.
Yeah.
That would really be maintained and that would burst into sort of international awareness at least. With the Matakana mine strike.
At first, police tried to block the march. The standoff lasted for half an hour. Although now carrying machetes, the miners argued their last march was peaceful. So eventually, police let them pass and escorted them to the mine shaft.
The point of this march is to intimidate anyone from going to work. These miners say no one should be reporting for duty until their wage demands are met.
Miners didn't sign the peace accord and are refusing to take part in wage negotiations, which were scheduled for Monday. They say there's nothing to negotiate. $1,500 a month is their bottom line. The wage talks were called off because the other stakeholders realised there's no point without the miners on board.
The issue, as we have reported in a couple of days, past days, is the level of intimidation. I spent a few hours over the weekend. Clearly, workers are still scared. There have been threats that those who are reporting for duty, their homestead will be touched.
Food parcels are now being handed out at the mine where families are struggling. Neither can Lonmin afford for the illegal strike to go on indefinitely. Also paying a price for these scenes of unrest is the governing African National Congress, which can't ignore a protest from a community that represents millions who feel left behind in this democracy. These voices of opposition are determined to be heard. Tania Page, Al Jazeera, Marikana Mine, South Africa.
And with tensions rising on the picket line, 34 miners would be shot and killed on this day in history, 2012.
Police in South Africa are defending their killing of 34 miners yesterday. Video of the incident has shocked people around the world.
In South Africa, a deadly confrontation at the world's largest, third largest platinum mine. We need to warn you that this video is extremely graphic. You're going to see police opening fire on striking workers.
Tightly packed and staying low to the ground with spears, sticks and machetes. South African police force these miners into an area with razor wire. Then they box them in using armored vehicles. Then this happened. All of this to break up a protest by miners who've been demanding more pay. 10 people had been killed since the start of this illegal strike and violence blamed on union rivalry. Now more families will be mourning. But with alleged killers among their ranks, including those who had hacked two police officers to death on Monday, this was the bloody aftermath. Police pursued the miners and there was gunfire for another half an hour. Tear gas and water cannon too, as they rounded up the miners who had escaped the initial confrontation. Police on horseback swept the area looking for pockets of resistance. An hour after the first shots were fired, the ambulances arrived.
Some of the men who have been injured are receiving medical attention just beyond those cars there. Their family and friends have started to gather at the township area, which is just by that power pylon. There's a group of people getting together waiting for information as to whether their loved one is dead or alive.
Earlier, a union leader tried to get the miners to return to work, but they said they'd been promised a pay rise and they weren't moving until they got it, and their managers came to talk to them. Given the riches beneath their feet at the platinum mine, one union leader said it was only fair they get more pay.
As long as the bosses, senior management getting fat checks, that's good for them. And these workers subjected to poverty for life. Democracy, 18 years of democracy, the mine worker is still earning 3,000 under those harsh conditions underground.
What started violently has ended in bloodshed few could have foreseen. It has left labour relations at Lonmin Mine in tatters and families angry with grief.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.